I'm Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We're broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, we take a single topic, a serious topic, one that generally does not have a fair and objective presentation within the mainstream media. And we bring together individuals that can enlighten us, and hopefully through that enlightenment to empower us. Today, the issue is the one that impacts every single person in the United States, our healthcare system. Specifically, we're going to offer legitimate challenges to the strengths and weaknesses of Obamacare. We will take into consideration cost factors, the failures to improve the health of the average American, and the benefits of a Medicare for All or single-payer program. My guests will include Dr. Margaret Flowers. She is a pediatrician practicing in Maryland who's currently working full-time on the reform of America's health care in favor of a single-payer or Medicare for All system. She is co-chair of the Maryland chapter of the Physicians for a National Health Program and one of its advisory board members. The national organization now has over 18,000 physician members who support single-payer universal health coverage. She also sits on the board of the organization Healthcare Now. She received media attention after her first arrest during the Senate Finance Committee meeting on healthcare in 2009, and then a second arrest after attempting to deliver a letter to the White House in response to President Obama's State of the Union address. She will be joined by Dr. Michael Huntington, a retired oncologist and a former medical director of the Radiation Oncology Department at Good Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis, Oregon, where he currently resides. He is a founder of the Oregon chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. And again, that now has 18,000 member physicians. In 2009, Dr. Huntington helped create the Mad as Hell Doctors, who toured the U.S. speaking in favor of single-payer health care reform before the passing of Obama's plan. He is currently the president of the Healthcare for All Oregon Education Fund, Mad as Hell Doctors. The website, madasheldoctors.com. The Physicians for National Health Program website, pnhp.org. And hopefully they will be joined by Professor Jerry Friedman. He is professor of economics, University of Massachusetts, Amherst. He specializes in economic and labor history as well as the economics of healthcare. In addition to publishing reviews of the economic impact of our current private insurance-based healthcare model and the economic benefits of single-payer, he also has conducted financial analysis for single-payer initiatives in individual states, including Maryland, Colorado, and Pennsylvania. His articles are found on his website. Let us begin by saying hello to Dr. Flowers and Dr. Huntington, and also, who just joined us, Dr. Friedman. Nice to have you all with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
If you have not appeared on this program before, have not heard it, the format is a little different in that rather than have a back and forth discussion, I prefer to use this more like a classroom on the air, providing you with a great deal of time to share your insights so that we really understand the context of your arguments. That way, we are not left with bits and pieces of information, but really some structured and hopefully some constructive approaches to our problem. Now let me just go over from my perspective the issue as I see it. And I don't see it as a single picture. I see it as hundreds of pieces of a puzzle. For example, until the financial crash in Wall Street, the number one reason for over 10 years of personal bankruptcy was medical bills. And yet it was not addressed. I also see, traveling around the world as I do, that other countries provide very good medical care to their citizens, and yet it is not a high percentage of their gross domestic product. Ours in the United States is at 12.6%, and that is an enormous amount. This year we will pass $3 trillion. Then you might suggest that with nearly 900,000 physicians, with more than 6 million people working in scientific levels and doing research, basic and applied research, with all of our hospitals and drugs and medical approaches, that we should have the number one healthcare outcomes in the world. Far from it. And in fact, in every single indices, the latest statistics show that we are failing our citizens. And I'll get to those in the charts that have recently come out that will highlight that, including some Academy of Medicine statistics. One chart that's particularly important is the International Federation of Health Plans. Now, every year, a global insurance trade association with over 100 insurers in 25 countries provides a survey data of the prices that insurers are actually paying for different drugs and devices and medical services in different countries. And every year, the data is surprising. For example, in the United States, it costs twice as much to get a hysterectomy as in other countries, but also it costs far more to get almost every medical procedure. In fact, you could spend one night in any of the hospitals in New York City with no food, medical care, nursing attendance, nothing, just staying in a hospital bed, and I could provide you with a suite at the Waldorf Astoria with less cost. Something is wrong here. Also, my biggest regret about Obamacare is that when I've read it, and I have, I do not find where it actually prevents illness. And since my efforts are in preventing illness as a public health educator and a PhD in public health science, I would much rather we spend our energy and efforts on understanding the true nature of disease, and then from the smallest of our citizens to the oldest of our citizens, can we prevent heart disease, cancer, obesity, diabetes? And the answer in the majority of the cases is yes. And yet we're not doing that as a national referendum. And even when I debated the Surgeon General on national television, I was surprised when asked, what is your national preventative health program? And it was simply, well, don't smoke. All right, but lots of people don't smoke and have a lot of illnesses. You have to have something beyond that. And I was saddened and surprised that there weren't. But here are my specifics, because I'm not ideological. Anyone listening to this radio program knows that I do not offer a left or right perspective. I simply look for the truth. Here's what we're going to explore. We have clear statistical evidence that our healthcare system is in dismal shape. According to the Institute of Medicine, 30 cents of every dollar is wasted. Now that comes to $750 billion annually. The breakdown of necessary services, $210 billion. Insufficient delivery of care, $130 billion. Excess administrative cost, $190 billion. Inflated prices, $105 billion. Improper payments, $70 billion. Fraud, $75 billion. Professor Joshua Solomon at Harvard School of Public Health found that U.S. life expectancy for American males ranks 29th, 33rd for females. When he compared with other nations in the top 10, like Japan, Singapore, Switzerland, Italy, France, and South Korea, he found that these countries encouraged healthy behavior and healthy diets far better than the United States. And in the United States, it costs twice as much per person than the next highest country's healthcare model. So we're going to begin with you, Dr. Flowers. Give us first your overview of what you see the major problems in our existing healthcare model to be, and then specifically, what do you see in Obamacare that either contributes to that or offers a legitimate challenge to it?
Well, thank you, Gary, and thank you for giving me this opportunity. I think to begin with, the major flaw of the healthcare system that we have in the United States, and it's doing, it's doing exactly what it was designed to do. We are one of the only wealthy industrialized nations that has a market-based healthcare system. So our system is not, the bottom line is not health. The bottom line is that the private health corporations, the hospital corporations, the private health insurances, the pharmaceutical and medical device corporations are beholden to their investors to make a profit for them, and that runs counter to actually having a health system where you have to spend money on actual health services. So the whole kind of incentive of our system is the wrong incentive. And this is something that we've seen as an experiment that's been going on really in earnest since the 1980s, when there was a drive to privatize our healthcare system. And if we look, like you said, at our healthcare system compared to others, the other industrialized nations cover most, if not all, of their population. We leave 50 million people out completely who have no access to health insurance. So it's interesting when people talk about in other countries you might have to wait in line for care. There are 50 million people in this country who don't have a line to get into because they don't have that insurance. Then the private insurance that we do have doesn't actually exist to, as you said, so that patients can be healthy. Their motive is not to ensure that their enrollees have good health. Most people don't keep their private health insurance plans for very long, a year or a couple of years. So those insurance companies don't have a long-term investment in the health of their enrollees. They really see it as an opportunity. How long can we collect premiums from these enrollees, and how much can we avoid actually spending of those premiums for health care? So they try to attract healthy enrollees who won't need a lot of services, and they have an incentive to push enrollees out or to deny services through various mechanisms when they do need health care. So our insurance here is a flawed product. It doesn't really cover what people need. And as you said, the medical bankruptcies are a huge problem. The study that was done based on 2007 data showed that 62% of personal bankruptcies were because of medical illness or cost, and about 80% of those people had some form of health insurance. What's interesting is we don't have a national study since then, but we do have a study looking at Massachusetts, which has a similar health plan to what Obamacare is. And while their total number of bankruptcies went up because of the economic turndown, and the percentage of medical bankruptcies went down because the total number went up, but the total number of medical bankruptcies continued to climb. So I don't think that we're going to see that go away under the new legislation. And our system is just very complicated. As you outlined kind of all the different areas of waste, the bureaucracy that we have is amazing. The insurance companies have to spend money to design plans, to market those plans, and then employers, people have to find insurance consultants to help them try to understand the plans. And then once you have a plan that you've purchased and you need care, you have to figure out where you're allowed to go, and then how much do you pay for that visit, how much do you pay for the treatment, where can you go to get your tests, where can you go to get any prescriptions still that you might need. So it's very administratively burdensome. We really micromanage our health care, and that's part of the reason that it's so costly, and why we're not putting more money into actual health care services. So kind of the reason that the flaws in the new health care law, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, is that instead of moving us in the direction that most other industrialized nations have gone, which is to have a universal publicly financed health system, we've gone further in the direction of a market-based health system, and that's because the law requires that people purchase private insurance beginning in 2014 or pay a penalty for those people who don't otherwise qualify for public programs like Medicare or Medicaid. And we're taking billions, hundreds of billions of our public dollars and using them as subsidies to help people purchase this private insurance. And to have that money for those subsidies, there are going to be cuts to our social safety net programs. So instead of investing our dollars into more public health infrastructure, it's going into the pockets of the private insurance industry. And what kind of insurance are people going to have? Well, the premiums are not expected to be controlled under this new law. And there's some new data coming out where people are trying to estimate by how much of a percentage insurance premiums are going to go up. But it looks like it'll continue to be a double-digit increase in premiums. So then people have to make an economic choice of what kind of insurance can they afford. And there's four different tiers of insurance in the exchanges that are being put together. The subsidies only apply to the third tier, which is called the Silver Plan, which covers about 70% of health care costs and leaves the enrollee responsible for 30% of covered costs and all of whatever is not considered to be covered. And then the lower plan below that, the Bronze Plan, is a 60% plan. These are grossly under insurance plans. It means that when people pay their insurance premiums, they still have very high out-of-pocket costs through co-pays, deductibles, and co-insurance, and that leaves them financially vulnerable to not be able to afford care or to go bankrupt if they have a serious accident or illness. So we're going to see an increase in the number of people that are underinsured and continuing to not be able to access the health care that they need. The law does not have any proven cost controls built into it, so we expect that our health care costs, as you noted, we pay a very high percentage of GDP. That is expected to continue to rise. So ultimately, I think what we're going to see is that this law is not going to meet any of the criteria that were set out. It's not going to be universal. It's not going to be guaranteed health care. It's not going to be affordable. And I should mention that it's anticipated that at least 30 million people in the United States will still not have any insurance when this bill is fully implemented. I would say that I think that number is actually going to be higher because that number was obtained before the Supreme Court decision looking at, which looked at the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, but also looked at whether states can be required to expand their Medicaid programs. And it was determined that states would not be required to expand their Medicaid programs, that they couldn't be forced to do that. And so if we look at the number of states that are, questioning whether they're going to expand their Medicaid programs, it could be another 8 million people that are left without health insurance because of that. And then I think that we underestimate how many people are going to choose to pay the penalty rather than to purchase health insurance that they know is not really going to be there for them when they need it.
Very good opening statement. Please stand by. We're going now over to Dr. Michael Huntington. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Huntington.
Thank you.
I'm going to lay out a little different argument for you, for each of you, in fact. I was concerned when President Obama was discussing his health care plan that those individuals who I know, physicians and scientists and people who are really in the front ranks of seeing what is necessary to work with a patient, were excluded from the conversations. And then an investigation was done, and it revealed the same thing that happened with Hillary Clinton, with Clinton's program that she was promoting when her husband was president. And it was made to look from the outside that this would be affordable health care for all. And it was under 3 weeks that we found that there were over 460 lobbyists working for the insurance industry, private hospital associations, pharmaceutical companies that were actually writing the legislation, all hidden from public, never brought forward to have an open and honest dialogue. The same thing has happened with Obamacare, where the logs from the White House and the people who met regularly with the president and his advisors came with the legislation. Now, my first question is, what does it say when we have the pharmaceutical industry, the hospital, for-profit hospital association, and for-profit insurance company working together to craft the actual legislation that then is rubber-stamped by the White House and then sold to the American public when the individual and independent scientists, economists, and others were not invited to give their input? This, in effect, was told this is what it is, and then we were not told that there were people behind the scenes actually crafting this. Members of Congress did not write this. That is a matter of record. The industry wrote it. Well, what does that say that we have a Congress for? I thought the Congress was supposed to create laws, not private industries, and then push through those legislators that they are associated with in Congress. The forum is yours.
Well, I agree with your comments about how this law was formed. It was written by a Liz Fowler, an executive for an insurance company, on loan to Senator Baucus's Health Finance, the Finance Committee. And Dr. Flowers is much more able to speak on the details of that because she was right there in the room when this all happened. And I think it gets down to if a person with intent to do good things for the country, such as I believe President Obama did, feels he cannot be elected without help from major contributors from the industry, he will have to make deals. And that's the same is true for members of Congress. And it's a trade-off. And I think Dr. Flowers and I might disagree on whether the net result from the Affordable Care Act is slightly favorable or not. What I think is favorable is that it put before the nation that we should provide health care to every one of us. It's not that we're going to get there with this, but the ideal is there, and the elements of the bill that say you cannot have your health care taken away because you might get sick, the fact that it emphasizes primary care, those are all good things, and for each one of those good things, there were sections written by the insurance industry to protect the insurance industry. So that's my view of what has happened, and I have to say that I'm glad that these benefits have come from the Affordable Care Act, but I'm afraid that the insurance industry is undermining every bit of the good that has been legislated.
Let us not forget that two of the largest lawsuits settled in the United States in the past 20 years were by two of the three top health insurers, and one was for over $1 billion. And I was wondering at the time, what company, insurance company, has $1 billion in excess cash that it can pay a fine and admit no criminal liability? Their reputation's not sullied, even though they engage in illegal practice. And that's how profitable this industry is. It's an extraordinarily profitable industry.
Mm-hmm. Those fines are simply expense items that every insurance company expects to pay and every pharmaceutical company expects to pay.
A follow-up question for you, Dr. Huntington. Right now, most Americans are concerned about their health care. Because a lot of companies, when you look at the fine print, they're not fully covered for all the different procedures that a person could end up having if they were in an auto accident, have a heart attack, have cancer. What should we be doing to ensure that every American, no matter what medical condition they present with, are covered so they don't end up bankrupt?
Well, I think Dr. Flowers mentioned the path that she was hoping for, and I also want for our country, and that is a publicly managed, publicly financed, and perhaps privately delivered healthcare system that does follow principles that she mentioned are not being met. And I don't think we're genetically different from all the other wealthy countries that have figured out how to do this. The system has to be transparent, truly transparent, accountable to each of us, encourages us to participate in the design of the plan, and certainly we were not invited to participate in 2009. It needs to be equitable, covering all of us, all residents of the nation, and it needs to be considered a public good. So that means you can call it single payer or as many countries have. They're not truly single payer. They're multiple payers, but they follow very strict pricing regulation and uniformity that make them behave as though they are single payer. I think that's what we need.
I appreciate that. We'll be coming back to you for follow-up question list now. Say hello to Dr. Gerald Jerry Friedman. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to ask you a rather extended introduction to a question that needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, most people in the United States get most of their information on healthcare from either the corporate left or the corporate right. And just to address these issues of their concern, I would appreciate that you take any one of them. For example, there really are two main groups of criticism of Obamacare, the more pro-social groups that favor Medicare for all or single payer, and then the Libertarian and GOP faction that mostly oppose single payer entirely and would as well have only private insurance, and if people can't afford it, then tough luck. And you might want to take a look at both the opposition from the right, official right, and the official left separately, not to confuse the matters. Now, opposition from the right, and some may be founded or unfounded, the main one is the act's infringement on individual liberty and mandatory health insurance with penalties to those who aren't insured. And according to this group, Obama's budget gives the IRS $500 million to enforce the provisions of the program. Also, figures vary according to the source, but up to 20 new taxes on Americans are associated with it. And to control costs, Obamacare limits the options doctors and patients have at their disposal, and fears that there will be far more paperwork and therefore more administration needs and greater burdens on doctors, hospitals, and clinics. Also, there are fears that Obamacare will crush small businesses to require them to provide expensive health coverage they can't afford. And economically, this has a huge impact benefiting mega corporations. They also have fears that it will result in a shortage of doctors and force present doctors, some, to decide to leave the profession, which is probably unfounded as an assumption, since young people are going to need jobs, and this is not an economy that has shown major signs of jobs creation in other disciplines. Also, they use the failure of Romney's health care reform as an example of what will happen to Obamacare, and you might want to address that. And the right complains that Obamacare will add millions of more Americans to Medicare, but then
Medicaid, but
is that a good or bad thing? Now, on the other end of that, then there's the matter of more taxes associated with the plan. The Government Accounting Office lists 47 different taxes and regulations that will be enforced by the IRS under Obamacare. And so on the left, like Think Progress and Mother Jones and The Nation magazine and MoveOn.org, they think Obamacare is a good thing. They look at insurance companies can no longer impose lifetime coverage limits on your insurance and can't run out of coverage. There's no cap. The insurance insurers are preventing from expanding, exempting from pre-existing conditions, no longer permitting to deny coverage. And companies are forbidden to drop you when you're sick. And young adults, 26 and younger, can remain on their parents' programs. And Medicare prevention benefits come with a free visit every year. And small businesses get large tax credits, up to 50% for premium costs. And 30 million uninsured Americans insured with lower premiums, up to 130% of the federal poverty line. And insurers prevented from charging women more than men, and senior discounts on brand drugs. So those are some of the concerns, both on the left, official left, on the official right. Would you address these, please?
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And I think you summed up the left and right views, or the liberal left and the right views, very well. First, I want to go back to the very beginning. You said that we spend 15% of our GDP on health care. We actually spend 17%. The difference is a matter of a few years, because health care costs have been rising so much faster than the gross domestic product that the share that we spend has been rising very quickly. By contrast, as you noted, other advanced countries spend about 10%. Other advanced countries, including countries like Canada. Back in the early 1970s, our life expectancy was comparable to Canada, and we were spending comparable amounts to Canada. Since then, our costs of healthcare have exploded, and their life expectancy has gone up faster than ours. So we clearly have a problem. The problem isn't just that we're spending a lot, it's that we're not getting very much for it. A lot of the complaints from the right about the Affordable Care Act are absolutely true. Administrative expense, bloated bureaucracy and everything. But to hear that coming from insurance companies and drug companies is a little comical, because these are the guys who have been bloating the American healthcare system with administrators and bureaucrats, with paperwork, with forms. And there's a very good reason for this. As Margaret pointed out, the system works very well at creating profits. And the basic way you increase your profits in a private health insurance system is different than the way you make profits by selling, you know, for example, cell phones. You make profits from cell phones by selling more phones. You make profits from health insurance by selling less health insurance, identifying the people who are going to get sick and getting rid of them. And the American health insurance system has become enormously profitable. Health insurance and drugs are two of the most profitable industries in America. Total profits last year of like $30 billion for these two industries. That's why they can pay so many lobbyists to go down to Washington. And that's why Rahm Emanuel and everybody else was scared of them, because they have so much money to throw at the system, throw at the political system. They make these profits through adverse selection by getting rid of people who are going to become sick, because most healthcare costs go to a relatively small number of people who happen to get sick. Find those people, throw bureaucrats at them, paperwork, or just deny them coverage, and you will get your profits up by getting rid of expenses. Now, the liberal left is right in a lot of what it says. That, I support the Affordable Care Act. I was thrilled when the Supreme Court surprised everybody by not overturning it, because it extends coverage to many people. Margaret's absolutely right, not to everybody. It has some very good provisions. The taxes that the right complains about are generally very, very progressive taxes targeted at the top 2% of Americans. So, yeah, I'm for it. But it doesn't address the real problem. The best thing you can say about the Affordable Care Act is, as was said, that it establishes a commitment to universal coverage. And I hope that we'll be able to build on that commitment. The only way we'll be able to build on that commitment is, as we found in Massachusetts, by containing costs, because rising costs are going to price insurance out of the reach of everybody and more people. If you look at the Congressional Budget Office projections, they anticipate that at the very end of the next decade, the number of people without health insurance will start to go up again, because healthcare costs will keep on rising and more people will start opting out of health insurance because it's too expensive, even with the subsidies built into the Affordable Care Act. The only way to contain costs is by going after the big inflation elements in the healthcare system. These are administration in the health insurance system, the administrative costs that the health insurers impose on providers, and drug prices. We pay 60% more on average for drugs than do Canadians. We have, last year I was testifying at the Massachusetts legislature, and fortunately I prefaced this by saying that my numbers were old, and I said that Mass General, which has about the same number of doctors and patients as Toronto General, has 250 people in its billing office compared to two people in the billing office at Toronto General, where they have a single-payer system in Ontario. A legislator came up to me afterwards and told me that my numbers were old because her husband works in Mass General, And they have 437 people in the billing office. That's what we've been seeing. These people are dealing with all the different insurance companies and dealing with all the different ways the insurance companies try to deny paying and try to drive out sick people. Altogether, I've estimated that we could save $600 billion next year if we established a single-payer system. $500 billion of that would be through reduced administrative cost. $100 billion would be by driving down inflated drug prices. We would wipe out the private insurance industry and all its profits. We would drive out a lot of the profits in the drug industry. And we would be able to use this $600 billion to provide universal coverage to everybody, real universal coverage, not 70%. As the silver plans that Margaret was talking about, but 95% coverage. We would do away with a lot of bankruptcies. We would make it easier. We would make the economy more efficient because workers would be able to get jobs on the basis of where they were productive, not on the basis of their health insurance status. Companies would be able to focus on doing their business and not dealing with health insurance, which is a huge expense that comes. Dealing with health insurance industry costs American businesses something on the order of $30 billion this year. And we would reduce stress and make life better for everybody. It's really a no-brainer. The amazing thing is that the insurance industry has been able to block this, the insurance industry and the drug companies.
Professor Friedman, a follow-up comment, please, from you. During the Medicare Act and its lobbying, I was told by a friend in Washington, this program is heard on our sister station WPFW in Washington for 30 years, I've been on the air there, and a person called and said, Gary, you won't believe this. I said, what won't I believe? He said, first, no one's read this bill. It only arrived today. On the night we're going to be seeing these people vote on it, but in the middle of this 1,200-page report, this bill, there is a rider in there that says that no federal agency, not the VA, not Medicare, none of these, can change the cost to the provider of the drugs. And as a result, they're going to heavy load in all their high-end drugs. It's going to represent about $1 trillion in profit over the lifetime of this law. That's how much they're going to make. And then I said, well, surely people will see that this is egregious. He said, it's about politics. It's about how many lobbyists are here. And again, about 2:30 in the morning, where it was not passing, they started getting together and these little groups, and then it passed. Well, within 24 months, 11 members of Congress or their top aides left and went to work for the pharmaceutical industry. The one man who actually sponsored this legislation ended up in a $2 million a year job with the top pharmaceutical advertising group in the United States. And so I went one step further. We decided how much these drugs actually cost. So we took the top 10 selling drugs in the United States, and we took a 30-day generic version. Same identical drug, mind you, no difference whatsoever. And the differences were astronomical. We found that many drugs have between a 7 to a 300,000% markup over its comparative 30-day generic equivalent. That meant that anywhere between $120 to $220 million, billion dollars a year would be made by the insurance industry, or excuse me, the pharmaceutical industry, based upon their margin of profit. And yet, when you go to get a less expensive drug, you can't. That's how powerful lobbying is. Is that the way that we should be approaching our health care, with allowing lobbyists to do this to us because we, the American people, end up having to pay for it?
Absolutely not, of course. One of the first deals that Rahm Emanuel made in preparation for pushing the Affordable Care Act was he separated the drug companies from the insurance industry by making this arrangement with the drug companies that the Affordable Care Act would not go after drug prices. That's politics in America these days. I'm not sure whether we can get decent health care in this country unless we have a major political movement to get money out of politics, stop this revolving door of lobbyists and legislators and legislative aides. It's like I said, I think the current health care system makes people sick, literally. It raises stress. Americans are less healthy than they should be, given our income, given our diet, our smoking status. We don't live as long as we should. If we were like people in other countries, we'd be living longer. And I think part of that is the health care finance system that makes people sick, raising stress and anxiety. And the political system makes people sick. You hear these stories about the, what you were just talking about, $2 million. God, that's a year's income. Sorry, that's a lifetime income for a normal person. So we need a massive political mobilization like what we had in the 1930s or the 1960s to change the political process so that we can get health care that will help keep us healthy instead of making us die.
I appreciate your comments. Let's go back to you, Dr. Flowers. I believe that we should look for the ethical issue involved in all this. Should we be caring about all citizens, their health and their medical care, as a human right? Your view on this?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's an ethical issue, looking at the human right to health care, but it's also what works. If we look around the world at the countries that have adopted health systems that are based on the human rights principles, which Mike outlined, it's universality, equity, accountability, transparency, and participation, those health systems function better than ours do. They cost less, and they have better health outcomes, higher satisfaction rates. So it's both an ethical issue, but it's also an issue of what actually works. And I think one of the things that we're not talking about on this call, and I think it's really a very important issue, is that one of the drivers of the poor health status in this country is the degree of wealth inequality. And this has to do with the type of economic and political system that we have, which in which those who are profiting from the different systems that we have, our health system, our prison system, our education system, those who are making the profits are the ones who are influencing the politicians and writing the policies in their favor. And the rest of us are really left with very little political power, very little voice in this process. And so addressing wealth inequality, for one purpose, to help increase our political power is important, but wealth inequality is also one of the biggest drivers of our poor health because of lack of education, not having enough money to pay for your basic needs, living in an area that has high rates of violence. If we look at all the different social indicators, they're poor, we fare poorly because of the wealth inequality. Even something as basic as trust in the United States, we have very low levels of trust compared to other nations, and that's as a book that's called The Spirit Level showed was tied to the wealth inequality in this country.
A follow-up issue, if you would, please. I'm sure you're familiar with ALEC.
Yes.
The American Legislative Exchange Council. And who knew that they were in existence for over 35 years, over 300 major multinational corporations who met twice a year with state legislators. They would provide the legislators with coaching sessions on bills that they wanted to have passed. They would then vote in private with the legislators when the legislators were unanimous and had sponsors of the legislation in a state, New Jersey, in every single state, New York, they would go back and then they would introduce that legislation as if it were their own. At no time would ALEC or its real founding behind-the-scenes sponsors or lobbyists ever be known. It was only when this was exposed just less than 18 months ago, after 35 years, that we began to see that virtually half of all legislation in states each year comes through ALEC, and over 2,000 of our legislators, that's 40% of the 50 state legislators, have signed on to bills and have presented bills and passed bills often that were not of their own doing, but they went along with it because they get political favors, they get funding.
Right.
What does it say about a system that both at the state level and the federal level, more often than not, have the hidden hand of special interests behind the scenes who do not have the humanitarian interest of the patient or the doctor, and frequently prevent the doctor from practicing the type of medicine, the time and quality of medical care with a patient that is needed and done in other countries? Your thoughts, please.
Right, absolutely. Well, ALEC is part of a broader strategy that was really laid down in 1971 by Lewis Powell when he was a tobacco lobbyist in Virginia. He, 2 months after he outlined this strategy called the Powell Memo, which he gave to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, he was made a Supreme Court Justice. But ALEC was part of that strategy to create this kind of, we call it a dating service between legislators and the corporations. They match them up. But it also went after increasing the number of lobbyists tremendously. It went after the schools, corporatizing our schools, taking over the courts, taking over media. All this was a response to what was happening at that time, the late 1960s and the early 70s, when there was a social movement that was demanding real democracy and real social change. And the market-based people were very frightened. They were concerned that we were going to switch to a more populist-based type of political policy in this country. And so they've implemented this. It's where we found saw the rise of the think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute that put out these ideas of, you know, the market-based kind of propaganda that so many people are subjected to. And I didn't realize Alex's reach was that extensive, 50% of bills, but I know that they've been pushing, and we've been fighting back against this one bill at the state level, which is called something like the Freedom to Choose Your Health, and it's really meant to keep a single-payer system from being able to be put in place at the state level, because it requires that people have a choice of health insurances. Under a single-payer system, everybody would be covered under one system that would be about actual health. And I just finished writing an article last night on the criminal injustice system, and ALEC has been tremendous in their power behind that for the private prisons and for requiring states to have guaranteed occupancy rates for their prisons. And also, they started 20 years before we saw this real explosion in incarceration, putting out the ideas of three strikes you're out and zero tolerance in order to get that thought process into the American psyche, which has increased the number of people that we've incarcerated. So it's they're a very nefarious organization. I think it's good that people are starting to learn about them, but their power is pretty tremendous and something that we need to continue to expose and fight against.
I've just finished a 10-week trip, my fourth in the last 5 years, of filming people around the United States, what I call the new poor, as compared to where I grew up in Appalachia, or the southern dirt poor farmer of Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi. These are frequently people who are college educated, even graduate educated, who today are not just in financial turmoil. They're highly stressed because they frequently see, after putting in a decade or two of loyal and quality work for a company, that company now has figured out how to, under a special visa program, to bring in someone who is also highly qualified with outstanding backgrounds, generally from South Korea or India, and taking their place for one half or less their salary and none of their benefits. And the numbers are staggering. It's just 8 million. Who knew? We know about illegal aliens. That's where the argument is, pro or con. But we're not talking about those that are coming in under legal visa, and why corporations are scrambling to get these because of what you save, and that adds to your bottom line. But in the process of doing this research, I came across, and this is typical, and it ties in with something you just said. I spoke with a woman in Texas who said that she now was being challenged to pay for her daughter's bills, and if she didn't, that she would be arrested and go to a prison, a private prison, that she would be arrested by a private security company, and that she would be charged about $180 per day. And her argument was, I don't have any money to begin with. It's not my bill, but you're making it my bill. And they've created debtors' prisons. Well, indeed, you look through ALEC, the very group you're talking about, there's now debtors' prisons in 27 states. And so who thought that we would find a time in the United States when there would be so much profit in getting maximum sentencing to have more people incarcerated than in Russia and China combined in the United States today, and also using them as slave labor. Now,
right.
this is off the point of Obamacare, but it is not in this sense. Virtually all the major lobbyists for ALEC have also been a part in the healthcare field, have been into the White House, into Congress. So they just take what their corporation is interested in and take it before the legislators or the committees that they have influence, and they get these passed. So on the one hand, they may be giving us a drug that has a 200,000% markup, and I know of several that fit that, at least two. And at the same time, they may want to have where a 500% interest on a payday loan. New York Times just presented that about 3 weeks ago in its front page cover story. So it's the same group of people. There's only one Alex. There's one business roundtable, but they control virtually our entire economic outcomes, and it just happens to be healthcare, but it's the same group of people. The ethics and morality are the same. Your thoughts on this?
Oh, we're absolutely in a debt-based economy right now, and I recently published an article that talks about access to health care and other basic necessities is a matter of life or debt. We worked with the Strike Debt Rolling Jubilee project that came out of Occupy Wall Street. They've been buying people's medical debt and forgiving it, but they do that not with the thought that that's actually going to, you know, change the system, but that it brings awareness to the fact that we have this debt-based economy, and they created a debt resistors organizing manual that's available for free on their website, strikedebt.org, for people to understand the debt-based economy, to learn what they can do to protect themselves, and also learn in their communities how they can come together and start to look at how public debt, which is used as an excuse to cut back on public programs and infrastructure, you know, is used to hurt their communities, and how they can fight back against that too. I just wanted to, because I don't want to run out of time and forget to mention this, but we haven't talked about as well the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which when we're talking about pharmaceuticals and medication prices, this is a secret trade agreement that's been going on for the last 3 years under the Obama administration, and parts of it have been leaked. It's been negotiated using 600 or more corporate advisors, although members of Congress and the public have limited access to what's being negotiated. We only know, the public only really knows what's been leaked to us, but they're creating kind of what we call an evergreen patent process for pharmaceuticals. They're extending the patents to 20 years, and then, but if a pharmaceutical company changes the indication for a medication or changes the delivery vehicle for that medication, that 20-year patent starts all over again. So what this is going to do when you talk about the price of generics, compared to patented drugs, it's just going to continue to make these life-saving medications out of reach for many of the population. It's going to hurt our own public programs who have to pay these prices, and it's going to undermine health systems around the world as well. So
it's NAFTA on steroids. We've done
we've done
four special programs on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We're absolutely opposed to it.
Right.
Back to you, Dr. Huntington. At this moment, what could those people in this audience do if they believe that our current system will not address the needs we have in a way that is more comprehensive, and they really want to go towards a single-payer universal health and coverage, but they were told by the left and right that that's dead. It's not going to happen. Could you inspire them, please?
Yes, they can do what I'm going to do in just a few hours. I'll go to our city council and support them in a resolution to have our state legislature conduct a feasibility study of single-payer versus other alternatives, including the status quo. I would ask people to gather their own stories of family and friends in their communities who have suffered, as we have in this community, a veterinarian nearly evicted because of a series of health episodes that caused her bankruptcy, people dying of strokes from hypertension because they didn't know they had high blood pressure because they felt they couldn't afford health care. Collect these stories, put them in video, take them to the legislators, let them know that their constituents are suffering, and that we know this will not change until we have a well-designed, publicly funded and managed healthcare system that includes everybody and considers healthcare a public good rather than a commodity.
I appreciate all of your concerns. Dr. Michael Huntington, whose website is madashelddoctors.com, as well as the National Health Program website, pnhp.org. Dr. Margaret Flowers, could you give us your website, please?
Sure. If you want to follow my writing, you can go to clearingthefogradio.org. We also have a Healthcare as a Human Right campaign here in Maryland where we're organizing the grassroots to understand their right to health care and how they can fight for it. And that's Healthcare is a Human Right Maryland, completely spelled out, .org.
And also, Professor, could you give us your website, please?
Oh, well, I don't have a website. I'm too antiquated. But anyone can always reach me through the economics department at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, where I may add we do a very different type of economics than you get from the lobbyists and the think tanks down in Washington.
And thank you, Professor Gerald Friedman. Well, you have all contributed substantially to this program. I thank you very much. It is the beginning of a dialogue that we need to have now. And let us not forget that these individuals you've been listening to are on one side of the equation, but up against them are enormous lobbying efforts with unlimited amounts of money, tremendous profits, and most importantly, more lobbyists work in Washington for the pharmaceutical and hospital and insurance industries than the other types of industries. So the game is fixed to a substantial degree. So all the more, I commend you all three of you, for the good work you're doing. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.